Hello, everyone. It's the Lookout Landing Podcast 2.0. I'm your host, Scott Weber, now and forever. I am the new head honcho at Lookout Landing, the Mr. Manager, if you will. So you're going to have to put up with me for a while, for now, and on a bunch of these podcasts coming up. Hope you're enjoying them. This is episode 4. We're listening to Gatsby's American Dream lead you in. Band Connor and I, our guests, both have mutual acquaintances in, friends, if you will. Connor is a baseball writer for Baseball America, obviously, baseball. He covers the MLB draft, and today we're going to be talking a little bit about the draft, some of the players the Mariners took, some players to look out for in the future, kind of how the whole process of being a writer and being a scout works and how they all kind of balance together. What's the difference between those two and what are interesting tools to look at? Really good discussion with Connor today, so thanks for tuning in. Without further ado, let's go ahead and welcome Connor to the show. All right, we're joined here by Connor Glassy of Baseball America. Connor, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on.
How's the week been after the draft, after all the buildup? Is it a little calm now?
It is. Yeah, I mean, it really, the draft is kind of a not only a culmination of a year's worth of work for us, but really, you know, that month leading up to the draft is pretty crazy. I mean, for me, you know, I was the main draft writer here. And so I've been covering these players for the past year. You know, I spent a lot of time last summer at a bunch of the big showcase events, watching the top high school players from around the country. And then kind of following, you know, what they did in the spring. But then really, when we get into the nitty gritty, when we really start going deep with some of these guys, and we had, you know, coming into the draft, we had reports on 500 players on our website. Wow. When we start doing that, then we, you know, work it more journalistically and start really hitting the phones to call scouts and call college coaches and, you know, use our sources to get information from people. So that's just a lot of work because, you know, not only writing up the 500 players that we had reports on, but we go, you know, state by state, even deeper than that, and try to list every player that is going to get drafted for each state. And it's, you know, it's hit and miss because after about, I'd say probably 15, 20 rounds, it can really spread out. And you know, as the saying goes, it kind of just takes one team. You know, it takes one team to like you and you can be drafted. So you might not be on everybody's radar, but if one team likes you, you can get drafted and that can throw things off a little bit. But yeah, it's nice to have that in the rearview mirror and kind of have a little bit of a break here. But, you know, for Baseball America and for the teams and scouts out there, it just keeps rolling right along because the next showcases for the 2014 class are starting right now. And the Cape Cod League starts on Wednesday. Wow. So, you know, the scouts out there, they don't get too much of a break. You know, it's it really is pretty much a year-round job. They do get a little bit of a break in, like, you know, November, December, January. Not too much going on then. But, yeah.
Yeah.
The summer showcase circuit right after the draft can really be a grind.
Yeah, I bet. So tell me the difference, and you had kind of mentioned this online, and I thought it was interesting. You talked a little bit about what's different from being a scout to being a writer to being just a blogger, and how would you kind of explain the difference between scouting and writing? And when you formulate your opinions on these players and give your take, how much of it is what you've seen with your own eyes, and how much of it is secondhand? And is that secondhand information ever thirdhand with some of these guys that are, you know, guys that are being selected in the 25th round that you really don't have a lot of exposure to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wrote about that online because, you know, it was just kind of a pet peeve of mine that. So many people out there, and I don't even know why this was kind of the case, but a lot of people thought that or tend to think that the writers at Baseball America are scouts. And while it is true that a lot of writers here have gone on to be scouts, you know, when we're here, we're not scouts, we're journalists. And it was just kind of me taking a lot of pride in the fact that I do have I've worked hard to create relationships and a network of sources who trust me as a writer and who trust what we do at Baseball America. And it, you know, I just felt it was unfair that the perception was out there that we are scouts because, right. Just because I know what goes into scouting and how much work that actually is. So for people to think that we're scouts, or for people to think that, you know, they can just start a blog and be a scout, I didn't like that, and I kind of took offense to that. And that's where that blog post you're talking about comes from. But yeah, I mean, we do cover games. We go out to lots of games, both at the amateur level and the minor leagues. And, you know, when we're out there, obviously we're seeing things, you know. But for me, the way I worked it was, if I saw something and I wanted to write something, I would always run it by a scout, you know, just kind of confirm what I saw or ask them questions, because really they're the experts. They're the ones, you know, putting their job on the line to sign these players. So I always felt it was important to double check that information, and really talking to them also provided a lot of invaluable information. I mean, they would tell me if I was on the right track or if I was wrong, or they would tell me, hey, you should go try to see this player, or, you know, I'm hearing this, I'm hearing that. So really, you know, we couldn't do our job here at Baseball America if it wasn't for the scouts and coaches who are out there every single day, you know, seeing things firsthand and helping us out with the information.
How tough is it to formulate an opinion on a player that you maybe only get a chance to see once, and then you're kind of supplementing with video and things like that? Because, I mean, a scout can go out to see one of these guys in, you know, a not heavily scouted area, and he sees him once and he has a great day or he has a bad day. Have you seen that kind of limited sample size in observations really inflate or deflate someone's draft stock?
Yeah, I mean, but that's why, you know, it's important to remember that those guys, the scouts, are the experts. Mm-hmm. And so when they're scouting a player, you know, you try not to let the performance sway you. So, you know, you could see a guy go 0-for-4, but you might notice that he has great bat speed, and maybe, you know, he just hit the ball hard at players, or, you know, all kinds of situations. That's why, you know, you can't just look at the stats to form opinions on the players. You have to really be able to, you know, see it with your own eyes and know what you're seeing.
Absolutely. When scouts are out and they're seeing a guy for the day, you know, a lot of times they have chances to interview them after the game, right? Kind of talk to them.
Sometimes, yeah.
What is your feeling on the whole process of the makeup tool? When you go through interviewing a guy, or you interview his coaches and hear what they have to say, how hard is that to quantify, and what are your general feelings on that tool?
Yeah, it is hard to quantify, but I believe it's very important. I mean, you know, I had a scout tell me, you know, in what job would it not be important? You know, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's baseball, or if it's, you know, if you're a car salesman or whatever your job is. I mean, you have to have work ethic to succeed, and you have to have, you know, that, and that's the thing, is that baseball is even tougher than a lot of jobs in many ways, not just for the skills involved, but just the grind of it. I mean, a lot of these players are going from playing, you know, a couple times a week to then they're playing every single day. A lot of them are moving away from home for the first time, and a lot of them are getting a lot of money. So you need to know, if you're a scout and you're putting your name on a player, well, you want to be sure that he's going to be able to handle himself accordingly. He's going to represent the organization well. He's going to represent you well, and he's going to have, you know, the makeup, you know, the desire and the work ethic to go through the grind every single day and be successful.
Sure. Have you been surprised at some players that have gone on to have successful careers that you've noted, maybe that you wrote about, they didn't have great makeup, or perhaps work ethic was a problem and it's something that they developed later?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about it like that. I haven't really gone back and, you know, tried to look at things like that, but that's interesting.
I'm just curious, you know, someone in your position, or scouts and stuff like that, you're always, everything's leading up to the draft and projecting a player career. And then when they get drafted and they progress with their career, how much time do you really have to kind of keep up with them and see what actually happened on what you projected?
Yeah, that's another question been fascinated with, just about how scouts and how scouting directors kind of judge themselves and judge the work that, you know, their colleagues are doing. And that's tough because, I mean, you can't base it too much on – it's just really tricky because on one hand, you want to base it on, you know, who does the best and who doesn't. But then there's so many other factors that come into it. So it is tough to kind of gauge that. And then just the other thing is that, you know, you're doing your job now, but you can't really quite tell who's going to be successful until, you know, probably 3 to 5 years
right.
after they're drafted, and to get the full picture of how everything might play out. So it is difficult, but I guarantee you that scouts do love tracking players from their area and keeping tabs on who's doing well and who's not, and trying to learn from, you know, their hits and their misses and things like that. I mean, you know, they're definitely paying attention to those sort of things.
Yeah. It's a fascinating, leg to me to think about that, because you have these scouts, you know, they could, make a great projection for a player and put their neck on the line for them. And then in 5 years when they become something, or they're determined not to be anything, maybe they're not a scout anymore. Jack Cerenzik is drafting
yeah.
these people, and Tom McNamara, they're scouting, they're pulling the trigger on these players in the draft, but will they be there to see their careers? It's always been very interesting to me.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So you're already looking forward to next year in the draft and thinking about some of the big names that are coming up and the showcases in the Cape Cod League and stuff like that. Is there one player that you've really noticed from not 2014's draft class, but maybe 2015, college or prep, who you really see that maybe people don't really know about yet because it's 2 years away?
Well, yeah, I'll give you one player who I think is going to be, you know, definitely looks like two players. These guys both look like first rounders right now for 2015. One is actually Mike Cameron's son. Yeah. And I've already had the chance to see him play a couple times now. 2 years ago I saw him play, and then last year I saw him play, and he's phenomenal. He's just extremely toolsy, you know, to me, and we'll see. Obviously, this is high praise, but he looked like he could be similar to Byron Buxton, who went second last year and got $6 million and is tearing up the Midwest League right now. So those are the kind of tools he has. I mean, he has exceptionally good bat speed, obviously, you know, the bloodlines with his father growing up around the game, and, you know, plays a good center field. He's going to be a really good player, I think. He's in Georgia. And then another player is LSU's starting shortstop, Alex Bregman. You know, he's a freshman this year, hit extremely well in the SEC as a freshman at a premium position, which is really hard to do. And he was one of my favorite players from last year's high school class. And now he's, you know, doing big things in the SEC. So he's another guy who I think will be a great pick in 2015.
Now, a guy that really was a premier high school bat this year and slid a lot, presumably signability issues, is Kayvon Biggio. And do you think he's going to follow through? He's going to Notre Dame, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, he's committed to Notre Dame. That's where his brother plays. I think it was signability. I mean, obviously the family doesn't need the money. And, you know, maybe he wanted to go join his brother. Maybe he just wanted that college experience. You know, his dad went to college. And so I would guess that's what it was. Because on talent, I mean, he was a very good player. He probably should have been a – you know, third to fifth round pick on talent.
Speaking of brothers, what do you know about Justin Seager?
Yeah, I know a little bit about him. It doesn't sound like he's in the same class as certainly as Corey or Kyle, but, you know, he's not as good as those guys, but he has some similarities. You know, he has a good feel for hitting. I think the biggest question with him is just where he winds up defensively. You know, he's a big kid, and he might not have the defensive abilities to play second or third base. So it might have to be a corner outfield spot. And in that case, you know, he could be a little bit of a tweener in, you know, not having the defensive abilities to stay at second base or third base and not quite having the bat to play a corner outfield spot. But, yeah, it's certainly interesting, and it's fun that, you know, he'll be able to join the organization that his brother plays in.
Yeah, absolutely. We I think I saw on Twitter that Kyle was watching the draft on his iPad or something like that and ran around screaming right when Justin was drafted by the Mariners. So that's always pretty cool to see.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
So tell me your general opinions on some of the bigger names that the Mariners drafted. Obviously, the big one is DJ Peterson, and you know we've seen so many things about him over the past couple of weeks as we've been kind of ramping up and looking into who the Mariners might draft. What is your take on him staying at third base, moving to first base, and kind of what is his timeline, you think, for getting to the big leagues if everything goes right?
Yeah, I'm a huge DJ Peterson fan. I actually, you know, kind of didn't think that he would be there for the Mariners at 12. So I was, I think it was a great choice for them because, you know, I think he has the best pure overall bat in this year's draft class. You know, there's better power hitters and there's better pure hitters, but well, not too many better pure hitters, but kind of when you combine both things, I mean, he's up there. He puts together great at bats. He has a really professional approach. You know, he's a guy who's going to walk a lot, lets the ball get really deep, and drives the ball to all fields. So, you know, there are questions about where he'll wind up. I think he'll start at third base, and if that doesn't work, you know, first base could be an option. Left field could be an option. But this guy's going to hit. I mean, I think, you know, at the worst, I think he could be like a Billy Butler.
Sure.
And at the best, I mean, I had names thrown out. Like, I mean, I had a scout put Jeff Bagwell on him. That's how much.
Wow.
That's how much he liked the bat. I mean, he said he was the best hitting prospect he's seen in 25 years of coaching and scouting. He was just amazed at how well he recognized curveballs. He hit everything. I mean, he just loved the swing, loved everything about him as a hitter. So.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
That's very exciting. Yeah, I've heard Paul Konerko is a comp kind of tossed around with him a little bit as well.
Yeah, similar kind of, you know, that'd be a pretty, you know, I think Paul Konerko, not a Hall of Famer, but in that next tier, you know, sure. I mean, he's a underrated, really good hitter with average and power. And so
it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Mariners definitely targeted power. If you look at their draft class, there's a lot of big, strong hitters in there.
Sure, and that leads us to kind of Austin Wilson, who's, I think, a bit of an enigma to a lot of Mariners fans. You know, you look at the raw stat line for him last year, and it's really not that impressive at the level that he was on. And there's been a lot of talk about his struggles and, in general, just the nature of Stanford hitters and how they haven't panned out going forward coming out of college. What's your take on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's true, but, you know, I would give him time just because he's so athletic that those guys, it's easier for those guys to make adjustments with that athleticism. I mean, this guy, you know, he's 6'5", 245, and just you don't see too many big leaguers with that kind of impressive physicality. So, you know, I think to get him at 49 was huge for the Mariners because – this is a guy who was getting some consideration in the back half of the first round. And, you know, you talk about tools. He's got all kinds of tools. I mean, he's, you know, he has tremendous raw power. He has a very strong arm. And if he can, you know, when he gets at bats every day and if he can stay healthy, he could be an he could be an impact player. So, I certainly have questions about him just because he hasn't quite done what you would hope he would at Stanford, but at the same time you have to like where the Mariners got him.
Right.
You know, it's not like they took him at 12, they got him at 49, and I think that could be a good value, and at least it's a good gamble for them to take.
Definitely. Yeah, he'll be an interesting one to watch, kind of a developmental guy, and see how he moves through the system. What's the deal with Tyler O'Neill? This is a guy, he's a shortstop, and then, okay, maybe he's a catcher, and he's from Canada, and a lot of people don't know too much about him. I didn't know anything about him before the draft. What can you tell us about Tyler O'Neill?
Yeah, he is interesting. I mean, he, you know, played for the Canadian national team, which is the best high school players from the country all play for the Canadian national team, and they basically spend their spring, they miss a lot of school because they spend their spring kind of traveling around. They take a trip, and he actually plays for another team called the Langley Blaze, which is the same team that's produced, you know, Brett Lowry and I believe Justin Morneau and Jeff Francis. But so with the Canadian junior national team, he got to go down to Florida and play some pro teams and extended spring training. Went down to the Dominican Republic and played some of the Dominican pro teams down there. And then with Langley Blaze, he went down to Arizona and played some of those teams in extended spring training. So this guy already has a lot of, he's already played a bunch of games against professional players, and that experience definitely helps. I mean, he's faced really good pitchers. But yeah, that's the thing about him is he started out as a shortstop, and then he kind of transitioned behind the plate. He's a stockier kid, especially his upper half. I mean, his dad was like a Mr. Canada, like bodybuilding champion. His, you know, worked out with Arnold Schwarzenegger and stuff like that. This kid is just jacked. I mean, he's got a, you know, very broad chest, big shoulders, really strong kid. And that's, you know, he had some elbow problems this year. And so combined with his kind of bulky physicality and his elbow, not a lot of people thought he was going to stay behind the plate. I thought he was at least going to get a shot to try it back there and see if they can loosen him up and, you know, work on some things. But the Mariners picked him as an outfielder. So I think they just want to stick him in the outfield and let him hit, you know, don't want to impede the progress of his bat.
Sure.
But yeah, he can hit the ball far. I mean, he has a lot of power. He has good bat speed. He's just going to have to work on some things, work on some pitch recognition and learning how to go the other way and things like that. But I think that'll come.
It seems to be a trend in this year's draft, because it sounds like kind of a similar profile to Corey Simpson, another guy that they drafted in the sixth round, I believe, a guy that is behind the plate currently, and they already have announced him as a right fielder. They're just gonna let him hit.
Yeah, Simpson didn't quite have his body was a lot sloppier than O'Neill's. O'Neill's, I mean, he's big, but it's really tight, whereas Simpson's, you know, not quite as toned as Tyler. So I didn't expect either. I expected Corey Simpson to move off of out of catcher a lot sooner. I expected Tyler to at least get a chance back there. I didn't think Corey would, but I think Corey will probably wind up at first base.
Cool. One of the questions that we had asked of us when I said that we were going to be talking on Twitter was that, what's the player in the Mariners draft class you think is going to have the most immediate impact outside of Peterson? Because he seems to be the one that's on everyone's list as kind of being the fast track guy, most professional ready. Who's the most immediate impact after that?
I mean, it would have to be, you know, there's still question marks, but I think it would probably still have to be Austin Wilson.
Okay. At the top of the draft this year, what do you think of the two pitchers, Mark Appel, Jonathan Gray? What's your take on the two? Which would you rather have for your team going forward?
Yeah, you know, I've gone back and forth on that. You know, I think it's really splitting hairs when you try to compare those two guys. We had Jonathan Gray ranked as the number one prospect in the draft with Appel too, but really, you could really go back and forth. You know, there was a while where I thought Gray was the guy, just because I think his stuff is a little bit more electric. You know, he's a little bit younger, but I think I've switched. I think Mark Appel, I'd rather have him, just because his stuff is still great, and he's got a little bit of a deeper arsenal of pitches. And the more I thought about it, I like his I like having that intelligence aspect there, you know, for a pitcher, and having that Stanford degree, that certainly doesn't hurt in that regard. So I'd take either one, but I think I would prefer Mark Appel.
Good, good. Last question about the draft. Is there a guy that maybe the Mariners didn't take, but any team took, people don't really know about, but he's a favorite sleeper of yours, and you think he could be a quick riser, get to the bigs pretty fast?
Quick riser. I really – well, I'll give you a couple. I really like Jimmy Scherfe. The Diamondbacks took him in the 10th round. He's University of Oregon's closer. He's got electric stuff. He gets compared to Jeff Spicoli because he's got long blonde hair and kind of a surfer attitude. But I like him just because his stuff is nasty. I mean, he's throwing a 96-mile-an-hour fastball and a hard slider, you know, and he's definitely a bullpen guy, so I think he could move pretty quickly. One of my other favorite sleepers was Riley Unruh, a shortstop that the Rays took in the second round. He's a high school shortstop from Arizona, and has a lot of speed, can play shortstop. Is a switch hitter with a quick bat. He was one of my favorite guys. And then one of my other favorite guys was Rowdy Tellez, two guys who I
What a
expect to end up
name,
in
by the way.
the Pac-12. Yeah, Rowdy Tellez, who is committed to USC, and didn't, it sounded like he was talking with the Mariners, and but then they couldn't pass on Austin Wilson, so they took Austin Wilson instead, and Tellez stayed with the number he wanted in terms of signability, and fell to the 30th round. He could be a huge get for USC if he winds up there, and Mariners fans who live in the area will have a chance to probably go see him play at UW. And another kid who they can see play at UW probably is Cal Quantrill, who played with Tyler O'Neill on the Canadian Junior National Team, and the Yankees took him late, but he's committed to Stanford, and I've heard that he's basically a genius. Like, he almost got a perfect score on his SATs, so he's going to go to Stanford, and I think he could be in the mix for, a first round pick in 3 years.
Now, how often is it that these guys that they set a signability number and then they tumble all the way to the late rounds? How frequent is it that these guys actually go out and work out a deal? A team's maybe got some leftover money from one of their earlier picks who decided not to sign with them or something. Is it pretty uncommon? Do you ever see teams, kind of steal away late round talent when they cough up the money?
It depends on the number, just because with the new collective bargaining agreement, you can only set aside so much money, and every team kind of plays that differently. So, depending on the number, I mean, I think, there weren't too many bonuses given out after the 10th round last year that were more than $400,000.
Yeah.
So, it depends on how much the player's looking for, but if they're looking to get, $500,000 to $1 million, then teams just probably won't be able to find the room for that.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll let you go for all the draft stuff. I want to turn the focus here to the Mariners a little bit. You're from the Seattle area. People should know that. Right?
Yeah, I grew up in Redmond.
Wonderful. So did I. Tell me kind of what's your take on the Mariners farm system right now, and especially Brad Miller. He's really kind of tearing up AAA right now. I was looking at the numbers between him and Kyle Seager, and their career path has been really, really remarkably similar. They're the same age when they entered professional baseball. Second round guy for Miller, third round for Seager. Spent about the same amount of time in every level, and now both tore through AA pretty quickly in their third professional year, and now Kyle Seager has turned into quite a good major league player, did excellent in AAA after only 24, 25 games they called him up. Brad Miller's at 14 games and he's just killing the ball. What do you think about him?
Yeah, no, I love both players. I love Kyle Seager, and I love Brad Miller, and those are both two players that, getting back to makeup a little bit, the sum is kind of greater than the parts. If you grade out all their tools, they don't look too sexy. But when you factor in the makeup, the work ethic, and just gamer mentality, desire, it kind of adds up to a little bit better than what you might expect. But Brad Miller, he's impressed. He's shown a little bit more power as a pro than he, was expected to as an amateur. And he's just hit wherever he's gone. He's he's an exciting player, and I like his potential to be some sort of big leaguer.
Do you think he has the ability to stick at shortstop? Where do you see him and Nick Franklin kind of shaken out between those second base and third base, or short, excuse me, shortstop position? Now that Dustin Ackley has kind of fallen a little bit, those two spots are going to be open.
Yeah, I think he could play shortstop. I think both could play shortstop. I don't think either one is going to be, Gold Glove winner, or either one's going to, wow people defensively out there, but either one could be solid, and if they're going to hit like they're hitting, then you'll take it. I mean, it's always kind of a sliding scale when you kind of look at defense and offense. And if a player is going to give you, you know, really good offensive output, you know, you can settle for a little bit less defense. Or if they're going to be like Brendan Ryan and be a gold glove caliber shortstop, then you can settle for them hitting like Brendan Ryan. But, you know, I think probably it's going to be Brad Miller at shortstop and Nick Franklin at second base.
And that leaves the question of Dustin Ackley. And today I saw an article Dave Cameron wrote over there at USS Mariner, and he kind of talked about maybe it's time to move Dustin Ackley to the outfield. And my, you know, I'm obviously not a scout. I haven't seen film of Ackley ever playing in the outfield or anything like that from North Carolina. It's my understanding that he played barely any outfield actually at North Carolina. It was just almost primarily at first base, moved there his freshman year, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
One thing that I've noticed, and it's really apparent when you watch film on Franklin versus Ackley, is that Dustin Ackley's throwing motion at second base is not smooth. It's kind of like a short arm type thing, and he certainly had a little bit of a habit of bouncing balls, especially when he had to throw off his back foot, kind of making that transfer at second base on double play ball. Are you concerned about his arm strength being able to play anywhere else besides second base? Because, I mean, I'm not an expert. From what I've seen, it's certainly a concern for me.
No, I mean, I wouldn't be concerned about that. I mean, with him, it's just going to come down to the bat. I mean, he's going to have to hit to get back to the major leagues anywhere. And it's all going to come down to the bat, you know, because you can look at guys like Johnny Damon, who – play center field with a terrible arm, but he hit, you know. So if they're gonna get Ackley back to the big leagues and put him anywhere, it's gonna be because he returns to being the hitter that, you know, they thought he could be when they picked him second overall.
Sure. You think he's more destined for a corner outfield role or center field?
You know, he might be able to handle center field. That's tough because Safeco is huge and he's you know, I'd say he's probably only a average to a tick above average as a runner. I don't think he's not a burner, you know. So, you know, I think you would want someone with a little more pure speed as your center fielder, especially at Safeco.
Yeah, he's really in a tough spot right now. I honestly don't know what the Mariners are going to do with him. I keep trying to figure out what it's going to be, and you hope that the bat is just good enough so that you can just put him anywhere and the bat will play. I mean, even if Smoke never turns it around, you got to stick him at first base. He can come out there and be a gap hitter, a guy that can bang out 35, 40 doubles. Okay, you can live with him at first base, but, you know, if he's going to be this guy that remains in the if he gets back to the high 600, low 700 OPS range, it's hard to see that bat really playing anywhere but second.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Tough call. Now tell me what you think about James Paxton. I'm a little concerned about Paxton. I've been concerned about Paxton for a while. He's always kind of come across to me as an Eric Bedard type, where he is just absolutely filthy but has struggles with control. Pitch counts are just going through the roof. He's really having a hard time getting deep into games in AAA. Do you think that he's a guy that the Mariners would be better off just either trading while he still has a little value as a starter, or is he a guy that you just want to put in the pen and hope that his stuff plays there?
Yeah, that's a great take with Eric Bedard. I mean, obviously he's bigger, but just in terms of the stuff and wildness and injuries kind of combined, you know, that's a great take. I don't think, you know, to be honest, I don't think James Paxton has a whole lot of value around the league. You know, so I think the Mariners might just be better off, you know, just putting him in the pen and, you know, seeing what he can do there. But then, you know, you look at it, they already have a lot of power arms in the bullpen. It's not like they're hurting for power armed relievers, so,
especially left-handed.
The
bullpen's full of them. Oliver Perez and Lucas Litchi and Charlie Furbush. They've got quite a few lefties in the system already. So,
yeah, but I mean, you know, his stuff is better than some of those guys.
Oh, yeah.
You just wonder how many strikes he can throw. But so, yeah, I don't know. I'm not super high on James Paxton's overall potential.
What do you think about Danny Holtzen? I mean, how concerned are you? This injury has kept him out a very long time, I think much longer than anybody hoped or anticipated, and it's really kind of set his timetable back. Do you see him getting up at some point this year, or do you think they're going to take it really careful with him?
I don't know. You know, obviously it's going to depend on what happens and what happens with the injury. But, I mean, it's tough to see because it looked like he was really turning things around at AAA. And then this happens. So that's tough. I wouldn't bank on him being up with Seattle this year, which is, you know, too bad because it looks like he was on his way to doing that before the injury happened. So hopefully, you know, hopefully for him and for the Mariners, it's nothing serious. But, you know, the longer he's out, the more it seems like it might be.
Now, I'm interested to get your take on Vinny Catracalla because he was a hitter that I personally kind of grew a fondness for, just kind of tearing his way through the minor leagues up until 2011. He was just destroying Double-A, and then, you know, he gets to 2012, gets to Triple-A, faces some more experienced pitchers, and it all kind of fell apart. And then he was really bad in Double-A to start the year, finally started getting good again, and then the Mariners cut him loose. What do you know about him, and what do you think he's going to end up being a contributor at all any day?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough because, you know, I kept him. We do our prospect handbook every year, and I've written the Mariners top 30 chapter for a few years now, and he was a guy who I kept in the top 30 this year just because, you're right, the year before was so huge. But I think, you know, looking back and trying to learn from some of these mistakes, I mean, I think it might have just been a product of the environment. You know, I mean, High Desert is such a hitter-friendly environment, and it's in the California League, which is a hitter-friendly environment. It's one of the, you know, the most hitter-friendly ballparks in one of the most hitter-friendly leagues.
Right.
So, you know, his numbers might have been a little bit of a mirage. That said, I mean, you know, scouts do, or at least did, like his tools. But I just think, you know, he doesn't put together quality at bats. And we've seen that when he's gotten up to Tacoma and this year, you know, back in Double-A against more experienced pitchers, it just wasn't there for him.
Yeah. The thing that was such a bummer for me is I always look for that, you know, that same kind of red flag when it gets to High Desert. And he came up to Jackson, he was just 22 and he murdered Jackson, but it really wasn't that big of a sample. I mean, it really was just a couple months that he really took down Jackson and he didn't sustain it for a long time. And it just all fell apart the next year. It's so weird that I see that happen with prospects so much, especially after they get out of High Desert. Sometimes they'll make it through Jackson, and then they just hit Tacoma, and it's just like they just hit a wall, and that's it. And then they go back, and everything's, you know, regression from there. What do you think that happens?
Right.
I mean, you think about a player like Brandon Wood, who was, you know, top prospect, 40 homers in a season in the minors, makes his way up, can't cut it in the bigs, and then all of a sudden he goes back down to these levels that he used to dominate, and now he's older and presumably better, but his stats are way worse than he was when he was 21, 22 in those leagues. What do you think that happens?
Yeah, you know, we've actually done some articles on that at Baseball America, and I think the biggest red flag for Brandon Wood that we didn't, you know, quite notice at the time was when he was tearing up Rancho Cucamonga in 2005, you know, he still had 128 strikeouts in 130 games. So when you're striking out that much against high A pitchers, that's going to catch up to you. You know, and it wasn't like he was walking 100 times. He had 48 walks to go with those 148 strikeouts. So, I mean, he pretty much was a two true outcome guy. He was either striking out or hitting home runs. And it's tough for those guys to succeed as they move up the ladder because smarter pitchers will know how to cut them up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the reason why I just don't believe in Alex Liddy at all. I just don't think he's ever going to be anything. That contact rate is so dismal. He's striking out more than ever. And yeah, he's got great power, but he's just going to get torn up in the bigs.
Right.
Another guy that is a kind of a riser in the system, but has kind of a similar red flag to him is Julio Mirbon. And he's hitting well in Jackson. The power has gone down expectedly from when he was in High Desert last year. But that's another guy. He's, you know, he's striking out more than once a game. He's still got, you know, he's still batting .317, but you have to wonder if that's going to catch up to him.
Yeah, I mean, his thing, he's always had great tools. You know, his thing has just been health. He's never put together, you know, a full season. So it's just a, you know, that's kind of, some scouts like to say that's the sixth tool because, you know, what good are your tools if you can't stay on the field? So yeah. It'll be interesting to see if he can ever put together a full season, you know?
that's an interesting question I have for you too, Nat, and it makes me think about that. Franklin Gutierrez, there's a guy who has been more snake bit, bad luck, injury prone than just about anybody I can remember. And he's coming back now from a hamstring injury, and it's taken him a very, very long time to come from back from it. And it's been an unnaturally long time to come back from all his injuries lately. Have you ever seen prospects go through the same thing and then it comes out that there's something just wrong with them? I mean, I don't want to, you know, speculate or anything like that, but now as Franklin Gutierrez continues in his career and he just picks up new injuries while he's rehabbing his other ones, and it just reminds me so much of Rocco Baldelli, you know, a guy who just couldn't stay healthy and no one could really figure out why. And then, okay, it turns out he's got a mitochondrial disorder and he just, his body doesn't recover from injury correctly and he's fatigued all the time. And do you ever see anything like that with prospects or anything like that?
I'm trying to think, you know, nothing immediately jumps to mind. I mean, obviously there's been, you know, numerous prospects with injury problems, but something like that, I can't really think of anything like that. But I mean, yeah, you know, you just, sometimes it's genetic, sometimes it's work ethic, sometimes it's just bad luck. But, you know, whatever it is, you want to, that's another thing that scouts factor into that makeup is just, you know, I mean, they do all kinds of crazy things from psychological testing to, you know, all kinds of different tests. They look at their parents to see, you know, what their parents' bodies look like, so to kind of guess how this player might fill out or you know, where his body could go bad. And they, you know, do all kinds of things to kind of figure everything out. But yeah, sometimes you just never know.
Such a bummer. Last year of the contract, and I think, you know, we may have seen the last of him in a Mariners uniform, and it's very depressing. I hope he gets back at least one time this year so that we can see him roam center field for one last time, even if it's a shell of himself. I only wish the best for him. You just hate to see players go through that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks a lot, Connor. I appreciate you answering all the questions about the draft and stuff like that. I'm sure the readers are going to appreciate getting a take on some of these guys we don't know as much about, guys like Tyler O'Neill. And best of luck with everything, and welcome back to Seattle next week.
Yeah, thanks. Hopefully I'll see you out at Safeco Field soon.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.